to focus, just to persevere and just to make it. But everything that's within your grasp, you gotta take it, you gotta go harder. Just dig deeper inside you to find that method, that mode that wants that hunger to survive. Just to ride the grind and take it the way you gotta take it and never stop.
I came to win, yeah, I came to win. I came to win, yeah, I came to win. I came to win, yeah, I came to win. Can't no one stop me, yeah, bring it in. I came to win, yeah, I came to win.
What's up, everybody? This is Kyle Hunter. I'd like to welcome y'all back to the Diagnosis Success Podcast, where we talk about motivation, inspiration, dedication. And as always, this is high-level conversation, and we just have some really dynamic and phenomenal guests on the podcast. And today's a really, really dope day because this guest is actually a near and dear friend of me. I've known him for several years, and you know, he's just a dynamic individual. He is within the medical field as a neurosurgeon, and I mean, he's just a dynamic person, father, husband, entrepreneur, businessman, none other than Dr. William Humphreys. Will, what's up, bro?
Hey, what's up, man? Thanks for having me on.
Most definitely, man. It's I'm sure that this episode, a lot of people, they'll appreciate it, man, just to really get to know you and, you know, about what you do, your upbringing, and just things that you have going on at the present moment. So once again, thanks for joining us, brother. We appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
Most definitely, man. So, you know, to start off, I know a lot of times, always say to guests on the show, a lot of people, they don't realize where you're going unless they know where you started. So for all the listeners out there who aren't familiar necessarily with you, can you talk about like your humble beginnings, like growing up, where you grew up, what that looked like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Milledgeville, Georgia. So most people don't know what that is. Milledgeville, Georgia is literally in the middle of the state of Georgia. It's very small town. I mean, when I was there, I think we had like one McDonald's, one shopping mall. But it was also an environment where, despite it being a small environment, there were a lot of ways in which, if you were creative, you could find ways to get in trouble, right? And so, you know, the majority of my friends that I grew up with at some point were either, you know, involved in, a lot of them were involved in drugs, either using or selling. And, you know, gang-related activities, you know, just to give you an example, my grandparents sold moonshine. So my dad's parents were moonshiners. And so my grandmother used to have this little store on Clark Street at the bottom of the hill. And it was a mom-and-pop store. And so my first interaction with just seeing how different things could be would be that I would hang out down there and watch people get drunk. I'd watch people fight, you know, people, you know, every now and then they do, you know, we'll be doing drugs and stuff like that. So, you know, that's kind of how I got my experience when I was in my, what I call my formative years. So my mom and dad were really, even when they were married, they weren't really together. I never had like a, you know, a formal unit like that, but I was raised by a village of individuals that poured into me, aunts, uncles, cousins, you know, just a very large family. So my mom decided when I was 13, this is probably not the best environment for you to stay in because you are starting to get in trouble. A lot of your friends are starting to get in a lot of trouble. And she just saw that was not a pathway that she wanted. So I had another aunt who had recently moved to Atlanta, and she moved, and we moved to Atlanta with her. So first, you know, she started out in East Point and then got a house in Lithonia. Just to give you an example, that my aunt, she started out in staying in another one of my family members' basement. Was able to get on her feet and got a house in Lithonia. So when we got to Lithonia, that was my first interaction to kind of, you know, living in the Atlanta area. Okay, so I'm thinking, you know, they're going to put me in this school that's going to, you know, have all these bells and whistles. And somehow I end up going to Columbia High School in Decatur, Georgia. So anybody knows anything about where Columbia High School is in Decatur, Georgia, that ain't necessarily the place you want to send someone if you're trying to keep them out of the type of trouble that my parents, well, my mom and my aunt were trying to keep me out of. But nonetheless, that was a learning environment for me. So I'm this country dude that moved from Millersville, Georgia. Now I'm at Columbia, right? And so I'm, you know, at some point I started to realize, you know what? I don't like being in this type of environment. I don't like having to worry about, you know, if something's going to pop off, if somebody's going to get fighting today, if I, you know, say the wrong thing to the wrong person, I'm going to get jumped. So do I have anybody around me that can help me, you know, out of that type of situation? And so I decided for me, you know, a lot of people, there were a lot of people that were smarter than me. There were a lot of people who had other talents than me. But it was that thing about me that I was uncomfortable that pushed me to say, okay, I've got to do something different. So what are my skills? What skill sets do I have? So I realized I wasn't going to be an athlete. I just wasn't, I mean, you know, I was like, I like music. I know I can play an instrument. Okay. And I'm pretty, when I put my mind to it, I'm actually pretty intelligent, right? I can. So I was like, my out is I'm going to college. I'm going to school. I don't really know what I want to be. I just know that the next step for me is getting out of the environment that I'm in. And so I had an opportunity to go to a lot of different places. I really wanted to go to Southern in Louisiana, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, because I just wanted to be in the band. That's what I wanted to do. But so kind of a funny story. I go meet with the people in the biology department there. And all I'm talking about is the marching band. Because I was like, you know, can I meet with Dr. Greg? That was the band director at the time. And so then they met with my mom. And I'm like, yeah, we think your kids can, you know, would do well here. Here's the problem. But we don't think you should come. And I'm like, what do you mean? And so basically they were like, look, if he comes here, all he's going to do is hang out and be in the band. We see it, right? And so if he really wants to go to medical school, he needs to go somewhere where he can focus a little bit better. Because, you know, it may be the case that he doesn't have the discipline that's needed to function in this environment. I was like, man, forget y'all, whatever. Okay, so I kept looking. And it just so happened that, you know, that I had some family members that went to Morehouse. And so I started looking around. And once I got to Morehouse, that's when I realized this is where I need to be. For the first time in my life, I was in an environment where it was cool to be intelligent. Right? You didn't have to downplay the fact that you were good at something. You didn't have to, as a matter of fact, it was the expectation. As a matter of fact, the people that were really cool were the ones that, you know, quote unquote, were on their shit. They were smart. They were intelligent. They could speak. They could dress. Also, they knew how to interact with people and formulate relationships. And so for me, that was a huge learning curve. Because number one, I was not used to being in an environment where it was cool to be smart. And number two, I realized that there are a lot of brothers coming out of high school that were much better, like further ahead of me. They were more intelligent. They were better spoken. They had connections. They knew how to talk to people. So Morehouse was the first time in my life where I decided, okay, I need to get my stuff together. And so that's how I started. And from there, you know, ended up going to med school residency, and we can talk about that if you want. But that was kind of my molding. I started in Millersville, Georgia. And at some point, I just decided I would look around, and I was like, you know, I don't, this is no disrespect to anybody that was there. I was like, this cannot be the rest of my life. So my mom would always tell me, you know, you cannot control the situation into which you were born, but what you can control is what you do when you're there. And so she used to tell me, the world doesn't give a damn about the fact that your dad's not here. The world doesn't give a damn about the fact that you're poor. The world doesn't give a damn about the fact that you are always angry about all of these things that happen to you. The world doesn't care. And the sooner you realize that, the better off you'll be. So you need to find a way to channel all of that anger, all of that displeasure into something positive to get yourself out of this situation.
Mm. Man, you dropping gems, brother. We in the jewelry store right now. You know, a lot of gems, man, like, you know, and just to unpack that, because you made a lot of powerful statements. One thing you said that I like was that, you know, you said that with your situation, you was uncomfortable, like you didn't want to settle. You know what I'm saying? And I think a lot of times people that come from communities that lack, a lot of times it's like they get comfortable. They get in a routine. So it's like, all right, you live in the hood. It is what it is. We got the bodega, the corner store, right? That's what it is. You know, we're going
to
play ball in the park.
I'm used to this.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It becomes regular, you know, and complacency kills. It's like, you know, I tell people all the time, don't let your current situation be indicative of your final destination, right? It's like you always got to push for more, you know? So the fact that you was in there, man, like that speaks volume that you had the vision to see more for yourself, you know? So that's powerful, brother. Another thing you said too that I like, when you talked about the village component, and we can unpack that too, because I think that that's important when people grow up in these communities, when we come from broken families and the structure's not necessarily there. So whether the father's not there, the mother's not there, or, you know, whatever the case may be, substance abuse, all these different obstacles that we have to fight through. But that's where the village comes in, where you have a support system where, you know, maybe daddy ain't there, but uncle can step up. You know, if your mom ain't there, then auntie can step up. Or you got grandma who's like the matriarch of the family. So these are all important components. And I love to hear that with your story, man. You know, I guess because I got a lot of questions to ask you, man. You know, and I know the listeners are really, really appreciate this episode. You spoke about Morehouse. Can you unpack Morehouse a little bit more? Because, you know, when people talk about HBCUs, you know, and for people listening that don't know what those are, that's like historical black college universities. So can you speak, because I know that you did go to quite a few different colleges. How was your experience at a HBCU? Like, how was it different compared to the other colleges that you went to?
So, and I'm not saying that everybody has to go to an HBCU to be successful. I have friends who have gone everywhere from Princeton to Georgetown to University of Houston, University of Texas. I tell people, when you're looking at schools and things, it's about fit. It's like a shoe. The shoe can look really good on the rack, but if it doesn't fit your foot, it doesn't matter how good it looks. If it's not functional for you, you won't thrive in that environment. I think Morehouse for me was a place that grounded me in terms of understanding what it's like to walk in this world as a black man who wants to be successful and who wants more out of life than he was given. Right. And it's not only enough to want that, then how do you acquire those skills and those tools to be able to do those things? Right. I'll give you an example. One of my best friends in this world was my roommate. And he's in Houston, Texas, named Jason Ingram. And when I was in college, I was a bookseller. I was always studying. Man, Jason, brother, could dress like no other. Right. So he always had on, you know, he always had on the polo. He always had on the suit. Yeah. So at first, you know, so this is a maturity thing for me, right? I could look at him and be like, man, why this dude always got this polo? I could have hated on him, right? Because I would say his thread game was way better than mine, right? But rather than hating, one of the things I learned was lean in. If somebody does something better than you, sometimes maybe God brings that person into your life to show you, and that's your opportunity to learn something. So it's okay to be competitive. It's okay to be in a competitive environment, but you also have to have it within yourself to be like, you know what, man, that brother like that, he's good with dressing. You know what, man, that brother, he's really well spoken. I like the way this person does it. So I just leaned in and I was like, hey man, you know, I like the way you, then next time. So you know what he did? We went together shopping for suits. And I went to high school in Decatur. I knew how to kind of put on the suit, but I didn't know all of the stuff, like the tie needs to stop at your belt buckle, cufflinks, what size shirt you wear. You can get a suit made, or you can get one off the rack, or you can buy it off the rack and get it tailored, and then it fits you better so that when you go into an interview, people are listening to you and not looking at the fact that your suit looks like a pair of, you know, cross color jeans, you know, all those things, right? So I give you an example. So fast forward, I end up getting these interviews for med school, and I end up having to borrow one of his ties to go. So the tie that he let me borrow was the one I wore to get into Duke for med school to open up another door. Wow. But it was that confidence. It was the ability to know how to put on a suit, to learn how to walk in somewhere and talk to someone. But also understanding the importance of developing relationships. So it's not enough to just, you know, make money. It's not enough to just try to be the smartest person in the room. How do you interact with people? Some of the most successful people I met at Morehouse were these brothers who were raised in environments where they knew how to talk to anybody. I mean, they could talk to the janitor. They could talk to the lady at the registrar. They always got their grade. I mean, they always got their classes registered before anybody else, because rather than arguing with the people, they bring them some coffee every now and then. Hey, Ms. Johnson, how you doing? Oh, nice.
Hey, Ms. Johnson.
And I'm like, so I'm looking at this. I'm like, man, what is this clown doing? Why has he got this bow tie on, you know, bringing this lady coffee? Yeah, but when it comes time to get registered for class, we standing in line. He's already going to the cast because he's figured out the hustle, right? And so sometimes for me, what the hustle looks like changes depending on the environment. And one of the things Morehouse taught me was how to walk into an environment and read the room. Okay, what are we doing today? What's the play here? Who are the major players? How are they interacting? What am I trying to get accomplished? Who in myself do I need to be? Do I need to be funny and charismatic? Do I need to be somebody that's suited and booted and, you know, showing people how articulate I am? Or do I need to just kind of sit back and let this play out? And so going to Morehouse taught me that. the HBCU environment, I think for me, was an environment whereby I learned how to open up and realize that for me, my definition of what it meant to be a Black man in America was very myopic. It was very small. And if I wanted to be successful, I had to open that up and I had to be open to new things, right? So just because you talk a certain way, just because you look a certain way, just because you dress a certain way, doesn't necessarily make you Blacker than anybody else, right? Mm. So there are a lot of things I wanted to try when I first got there as a freshman. I wouldn't do it because I'd be like, man, Black people don't do that shit, right? That was my mentality. Man, I ain't doing this shit, man. Black people don't do that. But as I progress, you start to realize, yeah, as a matter of fact, some Black people do join the math team or the math, you know. Some people do go into drama. Some people do some of these other things. And guess what? Because they're in that environment and you're not, that's the one leg up on you, right? So first, it taught me to expand my comfort zone, but then it taught me to do what I call expanding the zone in which you are comfortable. Because when you go out into the world, most of the time, for people that look like you and I, we're not going to be interacting with people that look like us, talk like us, listen to the same music. Now, there might be a couple of people sprinkled throughout, but you need to find out and be comfortable enough in yourself to be the, if you're the only person in the room that looks like you, are you grounded enough in yourself to know that just because you're there with all these other people, you have not compromised anything for your Black, about your Blackness. So a lot of people think that if you go to an HBCU, you know, it doesn't quote unquote teach you about the real world because it teaches you to only be in an environment where Black people are. No, what it does is it grounds you such that when you go out into the world, you're not tying your Blackness to what other people perceive about you. Mm-hmm. Another example, and this is a little bit of a long story.
Go ahead, brother.
When I was growing up, I was always the kid. I never really fit in anywhere, right? So I told you I had these homeboys I hung out with, and you know, they still my homeboys. They were involved in other things. And even though I wasn't necessarily in the streets like that with them, those are my homeboys, but because I wasn't in the streets like them, I never really fit in all the way, right? You know, I was always just, oh, yeah, okay. So then, as I, you know, kind of matriculated through school, I got put into a gifted program. Like, when I was very young, they realized that I had the ability, you know, to do this work, and I was intelligent. Okay, well, guess what? They take me out of my class, and they put me in this gifted program with all of these kids. There was one other kid in that class that looked like me. I had nothing socially in common with these people. We came from different households. When we went back, they went back to their environment, I went back to mine. So I always felt like in that environment, I also didn't fit in. So over here, I have my friends telling me sometimes, you know, well, you take classes with them smart white kids. You ain't Black enough. You good. You talk different. And I'm from Millersville, Georgia. To them, I talk differently. But to anybody else, I'm country as a brown egg, just like anybody else, right? But to them, they're like, man, you know, you're this way. Okay. I go to my, and when I'm in my gifted class, they're like, he's a little different. Like, I talk differently than them as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm always this person that's out of water. And so I spent all my middle school years trying to figure out who I was. So I was followed a lot of people. Sometimes I get in trouble. Wasn't until I got in high school, I got a little bit better, right? But still now I'm in Columbia High School. I got no friends. I got no homeboys. I spent my first year in Columbia just trying to figure out how not to get jumped in the bathroom, right? Like, which hallway do I need to take to get to class, you know? So then, because you got no homeboys at this point. At least when I was in Millersville, like, I'd be like, yo, man, these dudes over here tripping. I might need to do a little something for them later.
You had a team, man. You had your G-Unit.
Had a squad. Man, I got to Decatur, man. I had no wins, okay? But once again, I'm trying to define myself. And so I sometimes wouldn't tell people that I was as smart as I was. Because that wasn't what was cool. You know what I mean? Once I got to Morehouse and I got to HBCU and you're sitting at the CAF, you're sitting around people, one minute you're talking about politics, next thing you're talking about, you know, who Pac versus Biggie, which one, you know, is the best. East, you know, or the next day we're talking about New York rap versus down south, and but then immediately next, hey man, by the way, I need you to help me with this calculus because I'm about to catch this L tomorrow, and I need can you come by? Oh yeah, by the way, I got an interview tomorrow. Hey man, I need to borrow your tie, or hey man, I need to go get a suit. This one ain't fitting me right. Hey man, can you roll with me to the mall and we can holler at some chicks? But also, I need you to, you know, show me where you go to get these suits. you know. So it was that environment. And so then when I came out of Morehouse, I knew who I was. I didn't have to try to be anybody else. Now, there were different versions within myself, right? And I realized that there's a time and a place for everything. But just because I'm in an environment where I'm using correct English and I got on a Brooks Brothers suit, that doesn't make me less Black than anybody else in that room, right?
Absolutely.
Now, other people in the room may look at me and be like, man, who is this square? You know, square, like, who is this dude? You know, fine. Mm-hmm. No sweat off my back because I know who I am. And so I'm not saying that everybody has to go to an HBCU to get that experience. But if you are the type of individual that is kind of struggling with your identity, I think an HBCU is a good place to ground you in a place that nurtures you, that then will send you out into the world much more confident about who you are as an individual and what you want to do.
That's amazing, man. And you know what? I agree with you 110% because I feel that a lot of people, they need that. Because let's face it, when you grow up and you go to public school, they don't give you the experience that you need, especially minorities. Like, you know, we can call a spade a spade. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, there's a lot of racial history in this country, past and present, that minorities have to deal with and contend with. And you're constantly placed in a state where they suppress your greatness. So even from a young age, you know, they're teaching us all this nonsense about Christopher Columbus discovering America. How the hell do you discover something that's already here? Right. So they always champion their villains, you know what I'm saying, and minimize us, you know, when it comes to Black history. You know, you go to school and it's always the same ones. They talk about Martin Luther King. Half the time they only want to talk about Malcolm X because he was just too radical. You know, he makes a lot of people, privileged people, uncomfortable. So it's like, you know, right, you know, or they'll talk about Harriet Tubman, you know, she sat in the front of the bus. But our culture is so rich and so full, and there's so many other champions historically that they don't acknowledge. So I think, to your point, that's where the HBCUs are important, because they nurture that and they let you realize your value. You know, you come to terms with your greatness and your history, how rich it is, you know. And another thing that you said too, that is a good segue, man. I feel that a lot of times, as far as society goes, when it comes to Blackness and Black greatness, they try to stifle us and put us in a box. So what that looks like is, if you want to be dope, you want to be cool, and you Black, you got to rap, you better sing, own a record label, be in the trap, get the trap jumping, you know what I'm saying? Or, you know, play sports. Like, and you know, Black intelligence and being smart, it's not championed, you know, it's not commercialized.
It's like Biggie say, either you selling crack rock or you got a wicked jump shot. Right?
That's it. That's it. You know, and growing up, that's what you see, you know, and that's what you perceive as greatness. So I guess, you know, a good segue is, what did you see growing up that helped you change the narrative to say, you know what, I want to be a neurosurgeon? Like, what example did you see that shifted the paradigm for you?
So for me, this is something I think is really important for anybody. I think sometimes exposure creates the discomfort that you need to get out of your situation. So even though I grew up in that environment, I had an aunt. So I was raised pretty much by my mom and my aunt. They're like my parents, my mom and her sister. So she kind of adopted me as her child. So she was my other parent, basically, for the rest of my life, still to this day. She would take me places, right? So she would save up her money. Man, my aunt, when I was born, my aunt lived in a double wide trailer at the bottom of the hill in Dunlap in Millersville, Georgia. Okay, if anybody knows where that is, they know that there's nothing rich about that at all, right? But she would save her money. She would take me on trips. I mean, one time we went to just something as, in my mind, taking me to Atlanta and showing me what it looked, you know, what, and driving through a neighborhood where rich African Americans live. I mean, like, you know, your definition of greatness needs to be, you need to take this into consideration as well. Or like she paid for me to go on a field trip somewhere where I'd see something different. I remember one time we all packed in a Winnebago and we drove to New York City and we stopped in D.C. So I got to see the Capitol, I got to go to D.C. and I got to see. So my perspective of what's out there in the world was not limited by just me only having been in Millersville. And so then I'm like, this is not all there is. So for me, that exposure was like, well, if other people are living like that, I want to live like that too. I don't want to just live here and live in the hood for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think that you brought up something earlier is that I think one of the things that makes us one of a very strong race is also something things that keeps us where we are. And that's what I call resilience, right? We are very resilient people. Just think about it. If you are somebody that lives in Africa, if you're an African American and you live here, you descended from slaves that were brought from Africa over here, thousands, hundreds of thousands of which didn't even make it, right? So there was a lot of people on those ships that came over that didn't even make it. So for you to even to get here, there has to be a certain level of resiliency just for you to make it off the boat, right? And for them, for you to be able to have a family. And so, but guess what? In that resiliency, then it becomes easy to say, yeah, man, look around, this ain't that bad. You know, the hood ain't that bad. Man, like you say, you got the corner store up here, Candelator down the street, we having a barbecue tomorrow. I know I can go play some basketball over here. This ain't that bad. If I just stay here for the rest of my life, I'd be straight. I know how to do this for the rest of my life. But in that, and guess what? Most people may not be able to survive in that environment, but because you're able to survive there, you start to tell yourself that this is normal, unless you have exposure. Once you get exposed, it's like flying first class for the first time, or staying in a nice hotel for the first time. Once you see what's on the other side of that curtain, there's something in you that says, you know what? I want some of that too. And guess what? Not just because, quote unquote, other people have it. Like, there's one thing to want something because you see other people have it and you say, you know what? If I get that thing that they have, then that makes me just as good as them. No, I wanted a better quality of life, right? And for me to have the quality of life that I needed, I, number one, had to be uncomfortable enough to get up out of my situation, not make the same mistake, and, you know, decide that I was going to move forward. But I think it started with, for me, it started with that exposure. Tell you another story. When I was, by the time I got to my end of high school, by the time I, you know, I'd gotten some friends, I figured out the thing, I wanted to go to college so bad. I would meet with my counselor once a week. I would go knock on her door. Her name is Miss Bynum. And I would ask her, every day, do y'all have any new scholarships? I remember sometimes I would skip PE, I would skip lunch. There was this drawer in the counselor's office of applications that you could fill out for if you had a certain GPA and apply for scholarships, right? And nobody else would fill them out because they didn't feel like doing it. Man, I filled out like 20 scholarships. I might have got 7, but those 7 plus what I went to school for free. I went to college for free just because I was hustling the whole time, filling out applications. And to that, once she saw me doing that, I started doing that in 11th grade. She pulled me in the room. She said, look, I'm going to send you on a trip. This is exposure. And I'm sending you to this place every year, this consortium of HBCUs. They take kids and they expose them to healthcare professions. It's all paid for. They have a grant. They pay for your hotel, your plane ticket, food, everything. She's like, you got 2 assignments. Number 1, learn something. Number 2, you better not embarrass me. And she said, I'm picking you. She's like, I'm picking you. There are other people right now that if we were to go by grades, that have better grades, have better SAT scores than yours, but there's something about you that I think you need to be at this place. So she sent me. I go to the thing, keynote speaker. Guess who it was? Benjamin Carson.
Wow.
Now, this is before he, you know, kind of went where he went in terms of his political. I'm not talking about him in,
yeah,
in that.
Pre-Ben Carson. It's like pre-Kanye, the good one.
It's pre-HUD, you know. It's pre-. Before he jumped on and got, you know, became the, what was it, the home? The home, HUD? Got whatever.
Yeah, whatever the hell he doing.
Yeah, whatever the hell. That's whatever, man. By the way, shout out to Ben, whatever. But yeah, this ain't the same guy. This is like, so he would go around and he would do these talks, and he would talk to large groups of minority students about his story. And he actually has a story of how he got to where he was, that, you know, there was something in him in terms of his story that I saw myself. And he asked, and at this time, I don't even know what the hell a neurosurgeon is. Like, to me, neurosurgery at that time was like rocket science. It's something you say, but I didn't even know enough about what I did know about it to even say whether or not I wanted to do it or not. And he asked a question. He used to always do this. He would say, everyone to raise their hand. We put all our hands up. He'd say, you don't realize, but by doing that, you're brilliant. And he runs this neuron pathway. He was like, in order for that to happen, the sound has to come into your ear. It hits your tympanic membrane. It does a certain does a certain set of things, and all of a sudden it goes to your, from your cochlear nerve to your brainstem. Your brainstem, then it goes up into this part of the brain, and then it's processed, and then it's processing your frontal lobe, and then the other side of your frontal lobe then tells your hand to go up, and he was like, and he did a better job than I could have ever done with that, right? And he says, but you don't realize that, and all of that happens in less than a second. And you do all of those things, chewing, swallowing, all of this stuff that we take for granted, our brain control, and the fact that it can do all of those things while at the same time you're on your phone or doing something else, we are all brilliant. The brain central nervous system is one of the most beautiful machines God has ever made. And I was like, yo. Okay. So then when I came back, I didn't know that I wanted to do it. I didn't at that time know I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, but I did know what a neurosurgeon was. But then I started to thinking, well, what are some of the other things you can do? You can be a neurologist. Maybe I could be a psychiatrist. Maybe I could be an anesthesiologist, right? Maybe I could work in a lab, right? And do neuroscience and study Alzheimer's disease or study, you know, how neurons work. Mm-hmm. So such that by the time I got to Morehouse, I knew I wanted to be a physician. I knew I wanted to work in the medical field. And I knew I wanted to do something that involved either neuroscience or the care of neurological diseases. And so that was my segue. And that was just based off of exposure. That was based off of her sending me to something and me seeing something I've never seen before. Right? Now, think about how many kids, and I wasn't even the smartest, most talented person in my class or in the school at that time. And I was able to do that. So think about what would happen if all kids in the hood had that type of exposure, right? Could see something, another form of greatness. And this is no disrespect to anybody that's in the arts. You know, I love y'all to death. Or entertainment. There's nothing wrong with that either. That's how you, if that's your skill set. But I think kids also need to see that there are other great Black people that do dope shit in this world, mm-hmm. in science, in STEM, lawyers, judges. And that's what me moving to, Atlanta, that's the good part of me moving to Atlanta, I got to see, right? Mm-hmm. I had an aunt who was very well, another one of my aunts would do these barbecues. She'd invite people over and we're sitting around, we eating ribs and collard greens and catfish.
Mac and cheese.
I'm talking about the catfish that you put on the white bread with the mustard and you take it right out the grease.
You making me hungry, man. I need some fried fish.
But you know what type of people who come to those events? Judges, lawyers, people that were running for office, physicians. So now I'm sitting there eating this food with these people and I'm like, oh, y'all do this too? Yeah. So once again, just because you have a certain job doesn't necessarily mean that you can't relate to your people. But I started to see other people in that environment. And I was like, man, is this guy really a judge? Okay, we can be judges. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this guy works for, oh, okay, you work for Bell Lab? Okay. Mm-hmm. You do science, like you get paid? Okay. Oh, you teach at a college? Oh, okay. So now my perspective of when people say, well, you know, they're not letting Black people do those things. Yes, I'm not saying it's not difficult. But once you see somebody that looks like you doing something, I think that's why so many Black kids think that they can be Michael Jordan. Because they've mm-hmm. seen someone that looks like them dominate in that field. And once you see somebody do something, it's hard to convince somebody that they can't do something that they've seen someone that looks like them do.
Man, that's powerful, bro. That's powerful. And you know what? It's exposure. And without exposure, man, you know, people are limited, especially minorities, because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, I heard someone say before, which was powerful, the coach lasts longer than the player. So you can see,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? We grow up and it's programming. We look at TV, we see LeBron, we see all these KD, and that's what the goal becomes, because that's what you see, that's what mm-hmm. you're exposed to. But when you look at privileged mm-hmm. people, a lot of times their exposure level is different. They're like, well, you know, your great-great-granddaddy, he owns those teams. So now your level of exposure now shifts to being the owner instead of being the player.
Yes.
So, you know, just being exposed to these things, like you said, and being cognizant to say, you know what, I can do more. I'm not limited to just doing this. You know what I mean? Like, it ain't just
what I
about
see around me. Yeah.
Right. You know, it's not just ABC. There's a whole alphabet out here, you know what I mean, that you can pursue. So, that's a fact, man. That's a fact, man. That's powerful, bro. That's really powerful. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, because, I mean, you clearly you're a successful neurosurgeon. I wanted to know, like, what was one of the most, I would say, proud moments that you had as a neurosurgeon? Like, you know, something that you did, and that experience, man, just, it was like a culmination. Like, it just made it all worth it. Like, you felt like, man, I was able to save this person or whatever it was. What's one of those moments that you were truly proud of?
Well, I mean, you get a lot of moments like that when it comes to patients. But even on another level for me was what I realized is sometimes it pays to be a little naive and a little stupid. And I'm going to tell you why. Okay. So I went to Duke, did well in med school, and was fortunate enough to match into a really competitive and really good neurosurgery program, the Baylor College of Medicine. So just to give you a bit of an example, the Texas Medical Center is the largest medical center in the world in terms of number of hospitals, in terms of the number of physicians, and just square footage that's consolidated in one place in Houston. It's almost like a small city in Houston, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, this will be a great place to train. So I go there, and I meet some guys while we're training, and these are interns. They're general surgeon interns. We're all doing general surgery. One of them tells me, he's like, do me a favor. He's like, the next time, he's like, have you been over to the office, you know, where your program is? I was like, I've been there a couple, you know, but I haven't really been. He's like, next time you go over there and look on the wall and tell me how many graduates look like you. I'm like, okay. So I go look. What I realized was, I signed up to be in a neurosurgery program where they had never graduated a black neurosurgeon resident ever.
Wow.
And this is in 2006. Right? Mm. So in that environment, once again, and I had to dig deep here because now, you know, I'm around some really smart people, right? And neurosurgery is not for the faint of heart, and it's extremely competitive, and they have a very low tolerance for mistakes. Right? That's just the nature of the game. So now, where that affects me is, I'm like, man. So now I go, and I'm thinking every day, I'm thinking I got a target on my back. Even if it's not there, that's what I'm thinking. I'm second guessing myself, right? I want to ask a question. I was like, man, I want to ask that question, but damn, nobody else asked the question, and they probably already know it. So if I ask it, it's gonna look like I don't know my shit, like I didn't read, and maybe I should just be quiet, or maybe I should ask it because nobody else didn't know. So meanwhile, I'm having this internal conversation. I'm missing the entire lecture because I'm having this internal conversation about things I got to work through that are now taking me even further out the game. Long story short, that was probably the most difficult point in my training period, was finding mentors in that environment, number one, right? People that I could trust, and then feeling comfortable enough, like I was, for instance, in the HBCU, to be like, hey, man, I need your help with this. Because once again, I don't want to show these guys any weakness. I don't want them to know anything that I don't know. I don't want them to expose any weakness in me, because my concern is, rather than helping me, they're going to use that weakness to try to get me
get
rid
against
of.
You. Now, yeah.
Right? And so, but here's the thing. That was something I had to mature into, right? Was getting over that. But also, it's different. It's different when you don't have people that look like you that are mentors. It's different when you don't have the same rapport with your people that train you as other individuals do. Because when you're learning how to become a surgeon, it's very much an apprenticeship, right? That's what you learn in the book, but then also there's the nuance of the way people teach you and interact with you. And they can make that environment very enriching, or they can be as cold as a cleaver and not give you anything. Right. And so, long story short, I think one of my biggest accomplishments was I was the first African American to graduate from that program in the history of that program.
Wow, man. Wow. That's phenomenal, man. That's phenomenal.
So for a long time, I didn't share that with anybody. All right. Because once again, I don't want, because I do think it is a great training program. And I would trust anybody that got this. If you told me somebody was a Baylor trained neurosurgeon, I know for a fact they know their shit.
Right? Wow.
So at some point, but at the same time, I know that they didn't graduate their first person until 2012.
That's crazy.
9 years ago?
That's crazy when you put that in perspective. You know,
largest medical center in the world.
Wow.
Graduates his first black neurosurgeon.
It's crazy, man.
It's crazy. It's crazy, bro. Well, you know, I mean, that's a major accomplishment within itself. The fact that you were just able to do that, you know what I'm saying? Like, and you know, to rise above and to actually get out of your own head, right? Because sometimes that can be a problem. Like, you know, we present our biggest obstacle. We overthinking as opposed to just, you know, just letting it rock. So, you know, that's phenomenal, man. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you too, man, as far as a mantra, right? My mantra has always been throughout life, persistence wears down resistance. So I don't ever view anything as a loss. I only view it as a lesson. And any obstacles that's in front of me, like, I don't care what it is, I'm going to destroy it. I'm going to crush it. Like, you know, just being persistent. Mm-hmm. What is a mantra that you've had throughout your whole life that's kind of just helped guide you and keep you on the course?
Yeah, so I have a couple. I mean, I collect quotes, right? And that's something that helps me get through when I have this long collection of quotes that I use to kind of get myself out of my own head and to help me realize that I'm not the first person that's going through these things. These things have been in our society, and the people that break out are the ones that figure out how to function in these environments. So one of my favorite books I get a lot of my quotes from is Carter G. Woodson, The Miseducation of the Negro. And one of them is, you know, every man has two educations, that which he is given and that which he gives himself. Mm. Of those two, the latter is most important. What we are merely taught rarely nourishes us like that which we teach ourselves. Mm. So that means in order for me to be successful, I've got to learn how to teach myself. I've got to learn how to be an independent thinker and an independent learner. That doesn't mean I disregard what other people tell me, but I can't just sit on my ass and say, you know what? I don't like the way that person communicates. And so therefore, I don't like my teacher. My teacher doesn't, you know, communicate well with me. I've got to figure out another way to get that information. Mm-hmm. And so I need to be more proactive in learning how to teach myself and becoming a consistent lifelong learner, acquiring new skill sets all the time, thinking outside the box. Just because I don't know how to do something doesn't mean I won't try. Mm-hmm. You continue. And so for me, that's one that kind of, whenever I kind of get in a rut, I'm like, look, man, nobody's coming to save us. Mm. Nobody's going to do this for us. You know, nobody's coming to you. There are no heroes that are coming for us. Mm-hmm. You are your own best hero. So you have to figure out how to teach yourself. Right. You have to learn how to acquire new information and do that over and over and over again. And the other one I've had to learn is, in order to be successful, you have to become comfortable with failure. There is nobody in this world that owns a business, that has anything, that has never failed. I would argue that a lot of the people who are successful are the ones who fail the most. It's not necessarily the failure, it's what you do with the failure, and do you learn from it and make the same mistake or different mistake, and what I call failing up, right? So you, okay, yeah, we fail, we suck at this, but now we know what we suck at, and so now we can figure out how to get better, and you break out, and you make mistakes, and then you may lose it all, but eventually, the aggregate is, you are ascending. And I think for people, if you look at business owners, if you look at people, look at how many times they fail. If they were scared of failing, they'd probably be at step A. In order to get to step Z, you need to be comfortable with failure. You need to be comfortable with people laughing at you. You need to be comfortable with sometimes feeling humiliated. You need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Man, look, the jury store continues, bro. You dropping the gems. You making it rain out here. So, nah, man, that's true, though, man. You know, and I heard a saying, too. It's like, you know, you fall forward. So it's like, even though you fall down, you fall forward. You use that knowledge. It's not a loss. It's a lesson. As long as you're acquiring that knowledge, you know how to make the necessary adjustments. So that's a fact, man. That's a fact. Well, you know, man, I'm going to shift gears real quick, man, because I know, you know, you're my dear friend, but you know, I also know you're a hip hop head at the same time. I think a lot of people don't realize that about you. So who would you say top five that are alive? Who are your top five favorite? And we won't limit it to MCs. You could throw some groups in there too if you want a bit, but who are your top five hip hop, you know, of all time?
So full disclosure, first of all, this, as I have matured, this has change, right? Because now when I go back and listen to stuff, I hear stuff I didn't see before. And so I'll give you probably, there's my top five, and then there's what I call probably the greatest, right? My favorites, and then, all right. Okay. So I'll start with this. In my mind, the best, right? I got to go with Biggie, right? And the reason I go with Biggie is now that I'm older and I listen to his stuff, anytime you do something that's great, I think the great people, the really people that do it the best are the ones that make that shit look easy, right? He can just sit back with a microphone. Like, there's a video of Marvin Gaye laying on the sofa doing a tape where he's singing, and he's just belting out this song. He's making it look so easy. And the way Biggie tells stories, the way he puts words together, his articulation, like the way he does that, to me, I think I still gotta give him, to me, he's gotta be the GOAT. And then I would say maybe 1B will be Pop. And just because the amount of work he did in the short amount of time that he was here, I think, and that he still can resonate with people that are much younger, is to me is impactful. It's meaningful. And the reason that, for instance, like when I was young, I'm young, I'm rebellious, I'm mad at the world. One of my favorite ones was "Fuck the World." His whole but now because I'm a little bit different, I don't want to be angry all the time. I want to hear a story. Right? I want to hear, I need some imagery or something, right? So that's why, I put Biggie a little bit ahead of him. And then this is where it gets difficult, right? So there are a lot of good ones. I would say you gotta have Rakim, number three. And God, a lot of people MC. Be like, man, mm-hmm. A lot of people be like, you crazy, he's number one. And I get that. But he's another person, right? And he's another person, like, even, from where he's from, Rakim didn't even curse a lot in his. Very rarely did you hear him curse.
That's a fact.
It was just all vernacular. Just boom, 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 boom. Like, what's the microphone theme? I mean, I used to listen to all of them, when I was a kid. But now we're at number four. So this is where I struggle. Because then I think now I'm introducing my bias. But once again, I'm from the South. You gotta have Andre 3000 in there.
That's a fact.
In terms of people that could just put words together and the imagery and how he can tell a story. And also, I feel, once again, like, for instance, everything about that, what that group did to me was iconic. Like, you know how many people now say the South got something to say?
That's a fact. When they led the Source Awards,
right?
Yeah.
You know how many, that's one of my mantras. Coming from the South, coming from a place, Milledgeville, Georgia, where people, like, man, who the hell is this country ass dude? Like, he don't know what the hell he's talking about. They dumb. Yeah. South got something to say. And that came from those fellas were on stage. They had won an award. They like 18, 19 years old, won that award. And they're getting booed by people that they can out-rap.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in that situation, they get all in their feelings. They want to fight. They're like, no, South got something to say. And they just proceeded to whoop everybody's ass. Like, for the next 10, 20 years, just proceeded to whoop everybody's ass. So for me, got to put him. And then last, and this is not last, definitely, and you can probably flip all these around. I think you got to go with Nas. I think Nas is to me, another, like, the thing I like about Nas, and also Outkast, man, these guys were 18 when they were spitting that shit. Yeah. I know motherfuckers right now, today, that cannot rap like that.
That's a fact.
Right? They were 18 and already had all these stories that they could tell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they did a podcast on Nas, and he broke down with the professor. They broke down lyric by lyric. She would read it, and then he would read it in the cadence, in the way that he wrote it, and then explain what was going on. And I mean, this kid is 18 putting these words together like that. So whether anybody wants to acknowledge it or not, there's no way that you develop that type of vocabulary if you're not reading on your own. These guys had a way with words. They were articulate, and they could put these things together. They were well-spoken because they were literate. And so sometimes we focus on the fact of how they look and how they dress. I guarantee you all those cats, man, but whatever. I'm not going to get on the pedestal about that. Okay, so that was my, I think, top five.
That's top five.
Then I'll talk to you about who I'm listening to right now. And I don't know if these are my favorite, but who I'm listening to right now. Once again, Outkast. I'm going to always listen to Outkast. UGK, like, because I'm from the South.
Bun B, Pimp C, okay.
Bun B is one of those people that will get on your record and murder you on your own shit. If you better make sure if they're on your feature that you come with something, because that dude's a flat out rap to me.
Yeah, he do his thing.
And I'm biased, but so other people I'm listening to, Freddie Gibbs.
Oh yeah, Freddie Gibbs, man. He slept on, but Freddie Gibbs is nasty, man. He's
highly slept on.
Yeah.
Freddie Gibbs can. I don't know how he's so slept on, but yeah. So I'm bumping a bunch of Freddie Gibbs right now. Who else? I just left my mind. Okay, it's UGK. Listen to Freddie Gibbs. I like a young guy. I like Kendrick Lamar. I think he, you know, he is one of the young guys that actually puts words together and can tell stories. I think his first album, what's the one with the minivan on the front of it?
Good Kid, Mad City.
Man, that's a whole story. That's a novel.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was able to weave the minivan into it, and it's on the front of the, it's on the front of the, what you call it? The whole thing is about how, you know, they were in the minivan riding around trying to go get some tram, but then got into a fight. Somebody got killed.
Wait, hold on a second. Well, for people that don't know what trim means, can you tell them what that means? All the New Yorkers.
So trim is a word that we Southerners sometimes use to describe a certain type of activity that is very pleasurable that usually involves a man and a woman. And so rather than saying all of that, we just say trim.
There we
so
go.
So he was trying to get some, but no, he's riding around. He's trying to get some trim. They were in the minivan. They got into a fight. The whole time his dad's calling him, telling him, you better bring my damn minivan back. Right? Mm-hmm. That's a whole arc of a story right there.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then who's my fourth right now? There's another. Who else am I listening to? Oh no. I'd have to think about who my fifth. I'm just thinking, like, when I go through my what's in my list of stuff that I'm listening to right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of UGK, a lot of Outkast, Freddie Gibbs, Kendrick Lamar, and there's another one I'm missing. We'll come back to it.
Question I got for you too: who's your favorite female MC of all time?
Well, once again, I'm biased here, right? Because I always have, and I love my wife to death. I've always had a crush on MC Light. And I'm telling you right now.
All right.
When I went to they used to have clubs here, right? And my uncle used to help run a club. So I was up in the office. I wasn't supposed to be there. I don't know if I should pretend to be there. But anyway, MC Light came and did a freestyle against some other dude. And when I tell you, she flat out out-rapped this dude. And yeah, I grew up in that era. So I think my favorite female MC is MC Light.
MC Light.
What's yours?
Wow, I would have to say, for me, lyrically, bar for bar, I would have to say that would be Lauryn Hill. And only because, you know, she Lauryn was like she was a double threat. Like, you know, she could sing, but she could rap as well as she can sing. So, you know, I would hear her I would hear on the rap. Some of them bars that she would say, I'd be like, ooh, like, make the net. Like, I value a lyricist if I make the nasty face. Like, if you say, I'm like, oh, god damn. Like, yeah. I'm like, yeah. Oh, and she's doing this on records with dudes. You know what I'm saying? So, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I would have to put her up there, man. That's one of my favorite female MCs. You know what I mean? And the fact that I like that she was able to do it in a sense where she didn't have to sacrifice her integrity. Because to your point, like,
MC
Light. You know what I mean? Queen Latifah, these were queens on the mic, man. They weren't selling sexuality. And no shade to the females that do what they do, you know, whatever suits you, more power to you. But, you know, I just grew up in the era, and to yourself too, man. Like, we grew up in the same era. Like, lyrics were big, you know, and like what you said, like, you got to be able to spit. I don't care what you look like. You know, I want to hear what you sound like on that microphone. You know what I mean? So that's what it was. So, you know, I mean, big... Definitely, man. Definitely, bro. So I want to ask you this, man. Two last questions, man, because we're closing it, man. If you could, you know, I call this the Back to the Future question. You know what I mean? Where you get Michael J. Fox and the DeLorean, the crazy scientist with the crazy ass hair. So if you could have a Back to the Future moment where you travel back in time and you could have a conversation with young Will Humphries. And if you could give yourself some gems, man, like if they say, if I knew then what I know now, what advice or gems would you give to the younger self?
When my younger self, I would always do, my mother would always say, I would do all the right things for the wrong reason, right? So sometimes the only reason I got good grades is because I wanted to go outside and play. So I would do my homework in class. I would finish my work, do my homework in class. By the time I get home, I got time to go out and play. I don't have to. But during that environment, and I still do this, I think there's a difference between learning things for the purpose of getting grades and impressing people versus learning things for the actual application of the knowledge, right? Mm. So when I was a kid, you know, I was okay at math. I could, but I couldn't take that and apply it to anything. So let's say if tomorrow there was a time in my life where I spent so much time trying to become a neurosurgeon that the basic fundamental things that you do on a day-to-day basis, how to buy a house, you know, how to balance a checkbook, you know, how to apply for insurance, how to do all of those basic fundamental things, I couldn't do, right? And it wasn't because I didn't have the intellectual capacity. It was just that during life, when you were learning those things, I would learn them temporarily for whatever, you know, assignment I had in college, but I couldn't apply it. And so I always tell young people now, it's something I should tell myself. When you're learning about anything, if you're learning English, if you're learning math, if you're learning how to do, I don't care what, if you're taking an online class, I don't care. Ask yourself, other than getting a grade, how am I going to apply this in the real world? What skill set can I use this for something that directly impacts my life? And so I wish I'd had that more mature outlook on education, because I do think I got a lot from education, but I think I could have gotten a lot more and been a lot further ahead had I had that more mature mature perspective. And number two, nobody has a patent on blackness. Nobody gets to define for you what it means to be black, how you have to talk, how you have to speak, what clothes you wear, how you vote. None of that stuff is tied, what political party you're a part of, none of that is tied to your blackness. Now, I'm not saying that there is not a black experience that you need to be attuned to. Like, so if you wake up tomorrow and tell me, hey man, I don't think racism exists, or institutional racism is fake, or no, that's you being out of touch with reality. But who you are as a black individual, you get to own that as well. And it's because people will use labels to get you to do what you want. That's what we did when we were little. Like, if somebody's doing something better than you, be like, man, that shit lame anyway. I don't even want to do that. Lame to do that. I don't. And really, in your mind, you're insecure about the fact that person does that better than you. And so they've already put that label on you. If you want to be real, then you don't do that. Or if you do that, or if you don't give me what I want, or if you don't behave in the way that I want you to behave, I'm going to put a label on you to control you. I'm going to call you lame. I'm going to call you a bust. I'm going to call you gay. I'm going to say, you know what? This not. I'm going to question your blackness. And so rather than addressing the actual issue, I use the label to control you. That means, you know, you're not a Democrat if you do that, right? If you have that political, well, you know, that doesn't make you a conservative if you vote this way, right? Because conservatives would do that. Well, you know, if you, then that means you ain't black enough. Or, hey man, I don't know. If you do that, you might be gay. I don't know, right? And so there are these labels that people place on you to control you. And once you realize that, and you can be comfortable being uncomfortable, having people say whatever the hell they want to say about you, that's very liberating. Mm-hmm. But it takes some maturity.
Man, that's deep, man. That's deep, brother. And you know, at the end of the day, you're right. It's like, you can't live your life with these mental shackles that society and people place upon you. It's like, you got to free yourself. It's like, be free, be true to yourself, and then everything else will fall into place, you know? And truth be told, that's a crappy place to be in on the opposite side, where it's like, you're constantly living in a state of pleasing other people, you know, and just to be accepted and just to meet other people's expectations.
Because you haven't convinced yourself. Mm-hmm. You haven't convinced yourself of who you are. And so you're still in search of who you don't know. Mm-hmm. And so you're allowing other people to, and every time someone says something about you, you ask yourself, man, does that really mean I'm not black? Does that really mean that? No, you haven't come to grips with who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. So you got to go through that journey. And I say go through it early and go through it often. Especially by the time you get out of here in this real world, and you got to really box the way that you need to, you're grounded in something that is substantive and not other people's opinions about what they think you should be.
That's a fact, man. And something you touched on too briefly, because we talked about the racism component. I wanted to ask you, because, you know, obviously I live in New York. You live in Atlanta. What is it like
in Georgia, like as far as like the racial demographic? I mean, we've had a lot of issues here in New York, I mean, across the world, but what's the dynamic there? Like, I mean, what's your experience like there? What has it been like?
Well, it depends. It depends on where you are in the socioeconomic strata, right? Mm. I would tell you, but I would argue and I would submit that it's the same everywhere. Everywhere you go, but there's racism, right? It's like oxygen, right? There's no place in this world that you can go, unless you're in a vacuum, where there's not a certain amount of air oxygen, right? It may be on water, or you know, use whatever. Right? Now it may be in different forms, in different places, but it's there. And so, growing up in Milledgeville, Georgia, I've been called a nigger plenty of times. Got in the fight with people about that, right? My parents, my mom and my dad and my uncle, for them it was even worse. They would get locked up. They would, you know, people would come by and, you know, threaten to shoot up the store that my grandmother had, threatened to rob it, you know, white people at the time. And so that was that. And then that was my experience. And now, because I'm in a different strata, sometimes it's subtle. It's not necessarily somebody calling you the N-word. It's not necessarily somebody calling you or somebody riding around in the Confederate, you know, with the Confederate flag hanging and shooting a bird at you and telling you to go back to your country. Sometimes it's in the sense that maybe they don't approve you for that loan that you applied for, that small business loan. Or maybe they feel like you're not a good fit for the college, and so your application gets denied. Or maybe if and when you, you know, fall short, the way that you're viewed is different, right? You don't get a second chance. It's one strike and you're out. You don't get the benefit of the doubt of not knowing or not being prepared or having a bad day, right? Or you don't have the connections that other people have. And so you come into work every day thinking that this is the game when really there's a whole other game that's being played. And these people have already been groomed and right? So that's an institutional component of racism that sometimes you don't see until it's already happened or you're more mature. And I would say all of those things exist in Georgia, but all of those things exist everywhere in America and all over this world. It's just that sometimes the part that gets sensationalized is the overt racism that it happens, and it does happen here. I mean, you can go places and really know that, okay, this is not where we should be. I should probably take my gun if I go come over here again.
Now that's a fact.
But also, that's not, I would say that's not what people really, 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 that's not the majority of how racism plays out. It's that subtle stuff that you never see. It's somebody in your Bible study who, you know, y'all read the Bible together and then you go home and then when it's time for them to vote to help you out, they're like, man, I'm not. And they come back and y'all sing in the choir together. Y'all go to Bible study together, but when they vote a totally different way. Right? Or when it's time for, you know, you to be evaluated for a promotion or something, there are things that happen that absolutely have to do with your race. Right? I give an example. And this is not something that is a subtlety, right? When I go to the hospital right now, there was a time that people would often make comments about females, particularly African American females, if their hair was done a certain way. Let's say a little bit of blue here, a little bit of purple here, or somebody got a tattoo. If you go to my ER right now, do you know how many people have different color hair, tattoos, all up their arms? Some of them have sleeves. Not a problem. And guess what? I don't think it is a problem. It's not, that wasn't the issue. It was the application of the rule when other people did it. It was a problem. But now, when a certain demographic of people do these things, it automatically becomes validated. All of a sudden now, that's considered to be what's on in the arc of what you would call normal. By the way, I got to give a disclosure. These are my own personal opinions. In no way do they reflect any opinion of the institution for which I work. This is William Humphrey's talking. But when you start to see that happen, because a lot of people, we've seen, sometimes you can lull yourself into thinking that, you know what, I can't wait. I get this money. I get in a different environment and I ain't got to deal with these racist people anymore. There is no level of society, there is no club, there's no country club, there's no, I got like 7 or 8 degrees. There's no level of education that you can acquire that's going to allow you to get rid of to escape oxygen, mm-hmm. right? It's everywhere. What you can do is acquire skill sets that allow you to recognize it and play in that arena, knowing that it exists, but it's everywhere. So people always ask me, man, I'd be like, you know, what's it like living in Georgia? I'd be like, man, what's it like living where you are? My friends in New York, what's it like? How do you see racism play out? Because I'm gonna tell you, I tell a lot of people, I'm like, man, I can't be racist because I'm from New York. are you kidding me?
Oh my God, what is going on, man?
I can't be. I was like, man, and many times, So I always ask. So then I was like, well, what does racism look like to you? And really, what they're seeing, the only racism that they see is the Confederate flag, that sensationalized stuff. But the institutional stuff is the stuff that makes the policies that govern how we live our life. These politicians, the people that are actually writing the laws, right? They don't all come from Georgia.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy, bro. I think people from New York, they view Atlanta differently because 9 times out of 10, when people, especially black people, when they get sick of New York, first thing they call you and say, man, I'm going to Atlanta, man. I'm sorry. I'm going to Georgia, man. My auntie lived down there. She said she set me up. She got a job for me at the factory. Like,
They doing good, too.
They doing good, man. It's like black people in New York, they feel like when they move to Atlanta, all their problems going to dissipate. So they feel like, I can't tell you how many people I know went to Atlanta. So in their mind, they feel like it's the Mecca it's like heaven for black folk. That's how they feel, man. So, you know, it is what it is, man. It is what it is. But, you know, one thing that you said, man, that was pretty powerful, and I agree with you 110%, is when you spoke about the subtle racism. And I tell people all the time, man, the subtle racism, man, is worse than the blatant racism. I would rather someone outright tell me, man, I don't like you because you black, and I ain't giving you this money. Right, as opposed to all the nuances, the facial expressions, the energy that you feel. Like someone once spoke about the stress of just being black, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a real thing. It's like you can walk into certain rooms and you be the only person of color and you feel the energy shift, you know, and they trying to feel you out, see how far they can take it, what little jokes they can make, you know, talk about rap music, whatever. It just gets weird. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, what the hell, man? Like, you know, so I agree 110%, man. Like that's a fact. That's a fact, man. Well, you know, what I will say, man, this has been dope building, bro. I mean, you know, we have dialogue all the time, man. I just love
having,
you know, great friends of mine on the pod, man. And, you know, I just appreciate you joining us today, man. What, in closing, what things can you tell the people you got going on, man? You know, sound like to me, you need to be writing a book, brother. I'm going to be honest with you. But, you know, we'll go.
Yeah, I don't know. So there was some talk about that. I don't know. We will see. The only thing about writing a book is that, you know, some of the best stories that I probably could tell.
Can't tell.
Probably can't go in the
book. I know.
You know. Yeah. But, no, man. So right now I am in the process of doing more of this. Right. So if you have any more, I had a great time today doing more podcasts. I just recently did one with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution talking about strokes and how that affects the community, particularly people in the aging population. So we're really trying to talk more about that and build a relationship with the community such that the hospital system is not just seen as this sterile institution, but part of the environment in which and the demographic that it serves. And so really doing a lot of that. Still, you know, every day I'm doing the vascular neurosurgery. That's my thing. So take care of patients with aneurysms, strokes, AVMs, you know, vascular malformations to the brain. Just trying to get back into the swing of doing more normal things. So doing more presentations, going to speak talks in public because people are more used to that now. So, And in the book, we'll see. I think I just have to figure out a way to tell some of these stories without telling the wrong things.
Exactly. Gotta remix it, brother. Gotta remix it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Well, you know, we always appreciate you, man. We'll definitely have you back on, man. And you know, just much love as always, brother. And yeah, man, I'm gonna shoot out this soon, man. We're gonna chop it up.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Come on down.
Definitely, man. So once again, this is Kyle Hunter. It's been the Diagnosis Success Podcast. We just appreciate you all listening, man. And just much success, high level conversation as always. So much.
action.